You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to episode 70 of the Rex Chapman Show with my super dope homeboy from the next town, Josh Hopkins. Josh, relaxing here.
Yeah, hey,
buddy.
Happy holidays.
Good to see you.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Episode 70.
That's hard to believe.
It is. That's a great guest.
Yes. Yes, we have. And another one today. But before that, 70, I don't really know any 70.
I have no idea. No number 70s in any sport jump off the page to me right now.
No.
I'm just going to have to go with like a 7 and a 0. So I'm going to go Mickey Mantle, Tony Delk.
Tony Delk was a 00.
Oh, so that's 700.
Yeah.
We'll use it. Down the road.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll go Russ Westbrook, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very.
You could go Orlando Woolridge.
The big O. There. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you?
Sevens. I don't know why I always go Kenny Anderson. It was just an incredible time.
Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
But of course, the Elways, it's a lot of sevens.
A lot of sevens.
And zero, I would go with.
You don't know. You can't think of one.
Dame
Lillard. Dame Dollard. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love
that's
that guy.
A good one.
I want to have him on the show.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
We've had a lot of some crazy Blazer fans.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it'd be nice.
Josh?
Yeah.
Each week, we do a book club where we talk about what we've read the week leading up to right now.
Maybe give the people an idea of something they might enjoy reading.
So with that being said, book club, what'd you read this week, bud? Did you read anything?
Holidays, you know, it's so much, you know, I go see my mom. I do them, I'm wrapping gifts. I get so many presents. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a lot of time.
No, nothing.
This week. Now, what about you though? You're vociferous reading.
Well, interestingly enough, I have been sent several books in the mail recently.
All right, here we go.
From friends. And as per my rule, every time I get a book, I spend 1 week getting excited about reading.
Oh, okay.
So right now I'm in the middle of the week of being excited. About reading.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to spoil it.
So I haven't read anything.
Okay. Well, next week we will be waiting. Bated breath, because
unless I get another book in,
then
you can't read.
Yeah, while you're excited. Yeah, well, we'll see.
Yeah,
yeah, that's been book club.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, Josh, holidays are right here upon us, and it got me thinking about Christmas Day basketball. Before we get to our guest, how do you feel about Christmas Day basketball?
I love it.
You do?
Yeah. I love that it's there, but I don't always get to watch it.
Yeah.
Depends on, you know, you're at the whim of your family and who's opening and who's doing what.
Well, and you're usually really going,
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty drunk, actually. when food is served, when kids are restless, but I enjoy it.
Yeah.
They always put good games out.
I enjoy it. I also will say it's not the best to play on Christmas
you
Day.
Participated.
I participated on Christmas Day
like
game.
Family.
It was fortunate. I was in Phoenix. We played the Lakers on Christmas Day in like 96, 7, something like that.
Okay.
And and it was an early afternoon game, but it sucked because, you know, we had at the time 3 kids. And they were all under 7 or so. Santa Claus, big deal. It worked out for us, though. As players, we could spend Christmas morning home and drive down the arena. But it sucks for the opposing team that has to travel.
Yeah.
And anymore, I believe most teams do offer to take along spouses and children to away games. That was not something that happened back then.
Right.
But I enjoy watching football on Thanksgiving. Everyone enjoys watching basketball. It's just a little different for the players, but also what a privilege.
Yeah, well, how'd you do on that game? Do you remember?
Until I started thinking about it, I thought we won, but apparently we lost by 20 to the Lakers, and they weren't great at the time. They had Shaq, they had Eddie Jones, they had a young Kobe that wasn't very good yet.
Yeah,
we had.
What did you hold him to?
I think I snuffed him. He had zero. Yeah, he had 15 or 16.
Duck all over him. Yeah.
He didn't even score.
No.
It was that game, apparently, that, you know, some people say that really, really turned his focus around. And because he got wrecked, that one busted my ass.
Yeah.
He got it really good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you took a lesson.
Let's get to our guest, Josh. Yeah, you want to? I'm excited. I know I've brought him up. I'm sure I've mentioned his name a dozen times already on this pod over the course of the last year and a half. Let's get to our guest, college basketball analyst, hoops guru, Ohio State Mr. Everything. Welcome, Clark Clifton Kellogg Jr.
You went deep, Rex. Deep with your prep there, man. Very good. Great to be with you guys, man. Appreciate the intro. Glad to be able to pop on and chop it up.
I can't tell you. I bring your name up all the time, periodically with this pod, just because, man, when you were at Ohio State, Clark, I was in middle school.
And yeah, you're a little behind me. You're a little bit,
but it was just, you know, you're right above us in Ohio. I was in Kentucky, and the way that you just took college basketball by storm. I mean, and you know, a lot of times the best player from high school doesn't end up being the best player in college, and you were that. I got to get to one thing though.
Yeah.
It's all-time favorite thing about you. Where did you start and when did you start your free throw routine?
You know, Rex, I was born out of desiring to be a little different. I always had a little showmanship in me. Sometimes it got me in trouble, but I always tried to play the game with a little flair. And it was just a way, quite honestly, to distinguish myself from others. I look back at it now and I'm like, what am I doing? I actually rationalized it in my own mind as if I was catching a pass prior to going into my shooting motion. So that's how I justified it and rationalized it in my own mind. So Coach Miller, my coach at Ohio State, didn't really have any issue with it. But then I got to the NBA, and my coach at the time, Jack McKinney, wonderful man, said, hey, we're gonna deep six that free throw routine. No, let's go with something different.
Can you take us through it just visually and verbally for the people that are just listening? Kind of just take us through it.
Yeah, basically, instead of bouncing the ball, some guys don't take any dribbles, but most guys take some number of dribbles and have some kind of pre-shot routine at the free throw line. For me, it was simply I got the ball from the official, and instead of bouncing it, Josh, I just kind of tossed it in the air, caught it, got into my mechanics, and then let it go. Mm-hmm. Funny story. A guy by the name of John Johnson at the University of Michigan, my junior year, okay, I've been doing this the 3 years I was in college, actually intercepted my self-pass. Intercepted it. But it was not a legal play, so I got the ball back. But I think after watching it, he just said, let me see the balls. It's in the air. It's live. Yeah, right. Let me see if I can. So he actually took it, and the official said, get back here. But it was hilarious. And
that is great.
I saw him several years ago at a Final Four. And he said, hey, you remember when I did? I said, how can I forget it? You're the only guy who ever did it.
Clark, didn't they sort of ban that? You can't let the ball go now and then re-catch it. I thought they made
it. You know, I don't know if they banned it officially or if not, but I've not seen anybody do it. You know, it was a weird – again, it was just something, you know, to add a little flavor, a little differentiation. Actually – Now looking back, I should have been like an 85% free throw shooter instead of 75, 76. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Josh and I were just asking about the high school game.
Yeah, I mean, people, these young kids, they forget. And you are dominant. And you were dominant in high school and college. And you still hold the record for most points in the finals game in high school in Ohio.
No three-pointers. Yeah.
No three-pointers, and there's been some pretty good players to come out of Ohio lately. And so you had 51 and 24 in the final game, and you all didn't win.
Yeah. What? Yeah, that was painful. Yeah, that was painful.
That's what we want to know. Still painful for
yeah.
you.
Yeah, it is. That. It is. I mean – you know, I never won a Big Ten championship at Ohio State. My freshman and junior year, we played on the last day of the season with a chance to win it outright. My freshman year in Bloomington, lost in overtime to Indiana. My junior year, we had a chance to share the title had we beat Minnesota, but we lost to them at Minnesota. But typically when you come down to a game where it's winner take all for the championship, there have been some other games that maybe got away during the conference season that you might have should have won, perhaps should have won. But nonetheless, came up short in the state high school championship game. We had a really good team, had a great season. My numbers were born out of necessity in that game back in 1979. We were down big in the first half, and I basically didn't take it and shot it every time I could, basically. I mean, that's what it ended up being. I think I took 41 or two shots. And I still lament six or seven free throws I missed, the pass I made. I mean, you always tend to – Rex knows this, the guys who have played. Even whatever level, you kind of remember some of the low moments more than you do the high ones. It's just the way I think our minds work and the disappointment of not being able to come through. But it did lay the groundwork. My high school, St. Joe's High School in Cleveland, was all boys at that time. Since become co-ed back in 1990. But that was the first time our school had gotten to the championship game. Yeah. So I felt great about that. And then ultimately, our high school ended up winning multiple, I think six or seven state championships at every division level over the last 25, 30 years or so. So I had a hand in that. But that record only gets a chance to be broken once a year.
Right. Yeah.
The big school state championship game.
Yep.
I think John Deeble, who played at Ohio State and had a successful career overseas, got close. One or two other players may have gotten close, but it's a one-shot deal come March of Ohio basketball tournament time, and so far it's stood the test of time, and that's it'll be 44 years coming up this season.
So I'm always so intrigued with Rex. Rex was – he could have been governor. When he was
high school. It's different
not anymore.
Kentucky.
Not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. He couldn't be. But he was ballyhooed. He was, you know, first team All-American. He was, you know, and he was great in high school. And he always says to me that he always talks about he didn't know if he'd be really any good at Kentucky, or he didn't expect to come right in and be good or start, or he was surprised by a lot of that. You were so dominant in high school. Were you surprised at your early success, or did you expect it?
You know, I was comfortable with it because I had some good support mechanisms in my circle. I grew up in Cleveland. My dad had been a really good all-around athlete, so he helped ground me in what it would take to try to maximize my potential.
Police officer,
the other thing
right?
that really helped,
he's a
long-time police officer. Yep, for over 40 years. And, man, he gave me a lot of good foundational pieces around how to go about my game. And then being in Cleveland, the Cleveland Cavaliers, a number of those guys would hang around during the summer.
Wow.
Jim Jones, Campy Russell, Austin Carr, Mike Mitchell, Bingo Smith. And I had a chance to play pickup basketball with them in the summer when I was in high school. And as the older guys always do, Rex has done it with guys that come behind him. Guys that go before him have done it with him. They always kind of pull you aside when you show some aptitude and ability and try to give you some counsel and some advice and some encouragement. So I had that from the time I was 15, 16 years old during the summer. I knew I wasn't a pro, but hearing them and being on the court with them, even though they were going at 60, 65% and yeah. not being totally embarrassed and out of my league, gave me some impetus to think that if I stayed on this course, I got a chance to be where they are. And so that was extremely valuable for me in terms of my confidence and belief. And then as you go through each level, the players know before anybody else does. As you're competing with teammates, Herb Williams was a teammate, Calvin Ramsey, both first-round draft choices in the NBA before me. So being on the court with those guys and the Cleveland Cavalier guys I had a chance to spend time with kind of gave me a sense that I would have a chance. No guarantee, but I would have a chance to get to where I hope to be based on how I was dreaming about someday being able to get to the highest level.
Were you always going to Ohio State? Was anybody else in the picture? And talk to me about those teams at Ohio State. I mean, people don't know. I mean, you played on one or two of the best college teams ever to not win it. I mean, Herb Williams, Granville Waiters, Tony Campbell. And I was looking over the roster earlier today, Art Schleister for a year.
Yeah, Art was with us for a year. But my freshman year, Rex, I came out of high school in 79. And that class, for those that are historians of the game, the high school class of 79 is, by consensus and study, the best high school class ever. Because it included James Worthy, Ralph Sampson, Dominique Wilkins, Terry Cummings, Steve Stepanovich, Isaiah Thomas,
Sam Bowie, Dirk Minifield,
Derek Hoard, Quentin Daly, the late Quentin Daly, Byron Scott, Dale Ellis. I mean, I can go John Paxson. I can go on and not for just what the guys did in high school, but what they went on to become in the pros. And probably five or six are Naismith Hall of Famers in terms of what they did in the NBA. So it was a remarkable, remarkable class. And as I came out, I was considered one of the top one, two, or three players in that class based on whoever you were looking at. But I was consensus top five and one of the best, well, the best high school class ever by those who follow it. So my freshman year, Williams was a junior. Calvin Ramsey was a senior. It's one of the most talented teams in the history of Ohio State basketball. Jim Smith ended up being a third-round NBA draft choice. Carter Scott got a cup of water and a tryout and camp. So, I mean, and the Big Ten was loaded as a conference then, too. Isaiah was at Indiana. Mike Woodson was at Indiana. Ray Tolbert and Landon Turner, those guys were – I mean, it was loaded. Joe Barry Carroll was at Purdue. But I say that just to say that my freshman year was a really – talented group. And then my sophomore year, we kind of went off the rails, even though we had talent. Then my junior year, we kind of overachieved. Granville Waiters was part of that. Tony Campbell had a successful, very successful NBA career, terrific college player, and won a championship or two in the NBA during his time. But yeah, there was some really good talent rolling through Ohio State and the Big Ten in the time that I was there, the late 70s, early 80s.
Oh, Tony Campbell beat me up for a couple years. My first couple years, I was 19, 20, and he was getting big. He just won a couple titles in L.A., and he was getting big minutes with the Timberwolves.
And we
played them, and every time we played them, he'd just take me down in the post and just try to.
He was strong, man. He was strong. He was tough and athletic and knew how to score. He was a terrific college and pro player.
Clark, you mentioned your dad being a longtime police officer. You're the oldest of five that left you kind of be the man of the house a lot of the time. How did that mold you and, shape your future?
Yeah, you know, my mom and dad both are really foundational to how I view the world, as I grew up. And also I had really great support from them and extended family, aunts and uncles. All four of my grandparents were alive through my early 30s there in Cleveland. So I had a tremendous network of care and love and support. And my dad was our biggest fan, even though he was a police officer and oftentimes wasn't able to be there. As a matter of fact, he was, because he had flexibility with his job. He was able to be there at a lot of me and my brother's games. I mean, I can't recall him not being there, as a matter of fact. But his work schedule would take him away from the house at times, but his game, he made it to just about all of our games, which was a tremendous bit of encouragement. But just being in an environment, lower middle income class neighborhood, predominantly Black area, good families around us, and then the extended family, helped me have a sense of wanting to do well and wanting to make my folks proud. You know, I think some of that is birth order. When you're kind of the firstborn, you kind of get a little extra attention and so forth. And there's part of you that your part of your personality is developed by that. So I always felt like I needed to set a good example. I had my moments where I went off the, you know, when I went off the straight and narrow, but by and large, I was early on reminded to kind of do right, do well, and give your best effort in everything. And that's how I tried to approach it. And basketball grabbed me, and that helped keep me in line even more, because I really didn't want to have the privilege of playing basketball ever taken away. And that's kind of how my folks kept me in line. When I did stray, they take that pumpkin away and I'd straighten up in a heartbeat.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I want the listeners to know, most probably of this generation anyway, know you from TV and you know, college basketball analyst. But Clark, you were a high draft pick, and you were not only a 20-10 guy, or basically in college, you were, I think you're 30-10 your last year, but you were a 20-10 guy in the NBA for several years. And
as a rookie,
and as a rookie coming right in doing work. I don't know that people know that or know how difficult that is. But then the knee injuries. Yeah. And I guess my question is for you at that point, when you just realize you can't do it physically, how difficult was it? And how were you able to just take all the effort, energy, and time that you put into basketball and flip it into another passion?
Yeah, you know, it's a fairly simple but multifaceted answer I have for that. One, it was one of the hardest things I had to go through in acknowledging and coming to the place where basketball playing was going to be over prematurely. I got drafted at 21. I left after my junior year. I was 21 when I got drafted. I was announcing my retirement from the NBA at 26. After having shown the ability to be a good player in the league, was starting to understand what it would take to become great in terms of the work, both mental, emotional, and physical, and was on that trajectory and was looking forward to that. And then this left knee just started to have some issues. Cartilage worn away, three arthroscopies, and ultimately it can't stand up to playing the game that has carried me through college on a basketball scholarship, exposed me to people and things and opportunities that I only had dreamed about. And so basketball really had been the throne of my life. And it had really presented some positive experiences and opportunities, but it shouldn't have been on the throne of my life. And it was when it was taken away that I came to a place over time through some nudging from my wife, through some interaction with the local minister, that I got to a place where I started to allow a minister in Indianapolis to share the word of God with me and what that meant for how I was to live according to the scriptures, based on God creating me, having a purpose for my life that was bigger and beyond what I did. And over a period of months, as I was moving towards ultimate retirement, I didn't know it was going to be over in August of 87, but in November of 86, I began to spend time with this minister looking at purpose. And over a period of months, I got to a place where I acknowledged my need for God through faith in Christ, bowed my heart and life to Christ in November of 86. That's over 36 years ago now. And Christ became the throne of my life. God, through Christ, sat on the throne as the central pillar of who I am, who I'm to be, and how I'm to be, in reflecting who he is in every aspect of my life. And if I had to do it again, I mean, to have basketball taken away to gain God and Christ, I'd go through it in a heartbeat in terms of what I found in that relationship with the God who gives me life and breath. And that really, Rex, is what sustained me and helped me to move through the disappointment and the sorrow of losing what had been such a significant part of my life. I mean, it had given me so much, and yet my life is fuller now because I have God. God with nothing is everything. Everything without God, as I see it, is nothing. And so now that I have God through Christ, that is foundational in every aspect of my life. And some of the things we learn in athletic competition are universally transferable. Yeah. Self-starting, initiative, discipline, working with other people, handling failure, handling success. Those are lifelong principles that can have application and value in other areas. So I basically took the approach that I took to trying to excel and realize the dream of being a player at the highest level to how can I excel in this new lane of commentating. And that's basically how I approached it.
How did you know that was going to be? I mean, it's
one. I didn't.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You're great at this one thing. Very few people are just the best at two different things. The fact that you can get in, people don't understand the fact that you can get in front of the camera, look at the camera. It's something I don't do well. I don't look at the camera. You can look at the camera. You can look at your partner. You can do all of that, Clark, and you've always been able to do that. But then you became elite at it. Where did you get who gave you the first opportunity to do this? Yeah. And when you were at Ohio State, were you just sort of like I did? And, you know, it sounds like maybe you did at times. Were you just sort of sleepwalking basketball? Like you said, it was the throne of your life. Yeah. Were you, when you were younger and in school, were you thinking about what you might do after basketball?
I was, Rex. I was. Actually, there are a couple of things. My mom was adamant. My mom, bless her soul, she died way too early at 53 back in 94, complications from a surgery. We lost her. I was 33 years old at the time. But she told me early in my basketball journey, I recall this, I can't remember exactly, but I was maybe eighth or ninth grade perhaps. And she knew this dream was a fire in me, that I wanted to get to be a pro. And I had all kind of ideas about how it was going to happen. But she admonished me firmly. She said, if you think you're going to be this basketball star that you want to be, you better not ever embarrass us when a microphone is put in front of you. She told me that, and her brother, my uncle, told me that. No duhs and dums and you need to be able to coherently communicate and answer questions in a way that represents you and this family well. So I took that to heart. From the time a microphone was ever put in front of me as a ninth or 10th grader, as I started to excel and do interviews, I was ever mindful of communicating well and being a serious student, because of the stereotype around not just athletes, but particularly Black athletes, around not being able to excel on the court or field and be able to handle your academic business. So I was driven to dispel that. And I got great reinforcement from my parents, family, and teachers that I had going back to elementary school. So, and I've always loved reading and math, communicating, books. So that was part of what I enjoyed. And I always tried to excel in those areas. So that was part of it. The Pacers gave me my first opportunity on radio. I retired in August of 87. By late September, early October of 87, I was doing Indiana Pacers radio. That's Donnie right. Walsh, who was the president and general manager, I had built up some pretty good equity, not just with our team and franchise, but in our community. I lived there year-round. I really wanted to be responsible around the platform God had given me through playing to connect to the people that were supporting us. And that paid dividends in that Donnie wanted me to be connected to the franchise in some way. I wasn't quite interested in coaching or community relations. And we hired a guy who's been doing the Miami Heat now for 20-plus years, Mike Inglis.
Right.
He had just come down from Canada and got a job with the station that was carrying the Pacer games. And they hired him to do the Pacer games. And it was a great opportunity for me, recently off the court, knowledgeable about the game, to be his partner on radio. That was my beginning. And that same season, a station in Cleveland, where I grew up, was televising Cleveland State games on TV. Wow. The general manager happened to be a St. Joe grad. Knew I was doing Pacers radio. I had a tremendous following from my high school and college days. Would you be interested in doing a few games? We can't pay you much, but we think you've got potential and it would be great for our network. And I think it would be good for you. So right out of the gate, I'm doing 75 to 80 Pacer radio games and 8 to 12 Cleveland State University games. On a small scale, I have a chance now to learn the craft without a huge national audience. I'm rough around the edges, but I think I can be good at it, and I decide I'm going after it. And that was my beginning, man. That was it. Man,
that's just amazing. And it also prompts me to ask, so you've gone from a guy that's averaging 20 and 10 just a year before in the NBA. Yeah. Probably would have been an all-star if y'all's teams had been good, right?
Oh, man, that's another conversation.
Yeah. So, but now you're in the booth. You've connected with the minister. You've found your faith. It still has to be just hard as heck. On the buses, on the planes, you're traveling, going to games. You're watching guys that – you've played with, watching guys you've busted up on other teams. How difficult was that, Clark, at times? How really? Because I can only
early imagine. On it was challenging. Yeah. Early on it was challenging, bro, Rex and Josh, from the standpoint that I was only 26, 27 years old. And as I got off my knee and started not playing, it felt like it was enough for me to be out there. Mm. And I'm like, oh, shoot. But I knew the reality. My knee couldn't stand up to the rigors of NBA basketball. So I shifted my whole paradigm. And I talked about my mom and dad and teachers, but there's a mentor who's still a dear friend of mine, successful insurance agent, who actually befriended me when I was in high school. And I worked for him in the insurance business during the summers, just learning property and casualty insurance, getting my license. And he, too, helped me start to think about what could be possible beyond playing. Your name recognition is an asset. And you can leverage that, particularly if you go to Ohio State or any other place, you could actually leverage that. So I was starting as best as a 17, 18-year-old kid can think and start at least giving thought to what that might look like and how you can maybe set yourself up for success in every facet, knowing that basketball, no matter how long it lasts, it is ending at some point, whether it's through my injuries or Father Time. So I did have some of that working in my mind, and I didn't want my life to be just basketball player, maybe successful, and then fall off a cliff. I thought, hey, there's principles I can apply. I want to be impactful. I want to have influence. I want to be successful, and I'm willing to do the work. If it would have been insurance, I would approach it the same way. Start at the bottom, surround yourself with good people, and then show up and do what needs to be done. And don't necessarily wait for it to happen. I did the same thing in broadcasting, probing my partners. How do guys get good at this? Listening to some of the guys I enjoy. How do you get good? What's important? Be a good partner. Do your homework. Realize you're just beginning. Don't have all the answers. Be humble. All of those things I took to heart because I didn't want to be average. I didn't want to just be going through the motions. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to see if I can be good. And so I got good fast. And one thing led to another, from Cleveland State and the Pacers radio, the Pacers TV for 20 plus years, to the Atlantic 10 Network, Big East Network, ultimately ESPN, and then from ESPN to CBS. And I've been there full time since 97 in the studio and calling games, and have been very fortunate to do it with the folks that I get to do it with.
Well, we've been fortunate to hear you. You know, this community, we're both from Kentucky and we're in Lexington right now for the holidays. And this community, as you well know, it's college basketball. And all my friends, it's what we've cared about since we were so little. And to hear...
He's downplaying it, even though it sounds desperate. It's way more...
Hey, believe me, I know. Kentucky was in my top four. When I was being recruited, it was Ohio State, Michigan, Kentucky, and Notre Dame. Those are the only four schools I visited. And before Joe B passed away, anytime I would see him, if I was in Ruck, he'd point to the championship banner, and he'd say, Clark, if you'd have come here, you'd have got one of these.
Rest in peace,
Joe. Rest in peace. Josh and I Josh and I actually went to see him about 2 weeks before he passed. And it was an amazing man. Wasn't communicating very well, but he managed to tell a story about my grandfather that I had forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And he laughed and had tears in his eyes, and we laughed and had tears in our eyes for 5 minutes. But
what a gift. What a gift, man.
Well, to hear your voice now, just to hear the tone and the lilt of your speech and the way, like, it makes me so happy. You have a brand with it for me and for all my friends. Mm-hmm. For me, it's like, you hear the gong, I'm so excited. Yeah. It's March. It's happening right now. Cutting over here. Well, let's cut over to the St. Joseph's game. It's like, oh, yeah. It makes me so happy just to hear. Like, I should have, you should be my alarm. Like, good morning, God. Get up and attack the day. I would jump out of bed. And it's such a pleasure to have you, man. And I wanted to know, because you talk about the NIL, and I've heard you talk this past weekend, I think, a little bit about it. What do you think, because it's the Wild West right now, but if NIL, it went to the best place it could, what's the best of the NIL look if we were to adapt it the right way, and what's the worst of it if it goes the wrong way? What are those two?
Well, I think the best of it, and I'll kind of stay there because that's what I'm hoping we can influence and bring to fruition, is the best of it. The best of it is not being penalized for earning a college scholarship. That's first and foremost, that you're not penalized, that you have an opportunity, if you have branding opportunities, endorsement opportunities, that you can at least explore those if you desire and take advantage of those. The other component that I think is not talked about enough, the educational part of it, in addition to the transactional part of money. The transactional part, I think, gets way too much attention because there's a greater opportunity for transformation, not just a transaction, through education by way of NIL. And that's an institutional responsibility. That's perhaps an NCAA responsibility. That's an individual athlete and their family's responsibility to use the opportunity to engage in real life interaction in the marketplace for the benefit of you currently, but also for education that can serve you down the line if you don't happen to become a pro, or if you do. The whole premise around higher education is that you're preparing all of the students, athletes included, for citizenship and fruitfulness and success. NIL, to me, is an opportunity to put the education at the center. We're going to teach you about what a good deal is, what a good opportunity is, what a short-term, what a good company corporate relationship is, and how you can begin to decide and make decisions about where you are might want to have now, but what might be better down the road, and be able to bring that together in an integrated fashion for the education, empowerment, and uplift of those student athletes across the board. All student athletes are participating in NIL for different reasons. We've got 1,000 athletes in 36 sports at Ohio State, and the last numbers I saw, there are obviously some folks that are killing it, but they're not all just football and basketball folks. There's some volleyball ladies that are killing it. There's a lacrosse player, and some of it is social media. But the opportunity is there with the right education and the right support that it can really be a nice foundational piece to preparing kids for successful transitions to adulthood in the real world. But now, because it's the first question that many families are asking being recruited, particularly in basketball and football, what is the NIL? The relationship, NIL was not available when I was here, but I've been able to leverage through my education at Ohio State, through where God has taken me in my journey, through the relationships and my education that have been part of the family of being at Ohio State. Those things are valuable and can be actually amplified with NIL, in my opinion. So I really want to see federal legislation seems like it might need to happen so that there's a uniformity and a consistency to kind of close some of the loopholes and the blatant cheating that can take place that's unenforced now. If there was legislation with some bite, subpoena power, because I've talked to some athletic directors, then the cheaters would be able to suffer the consequences for their actions. Now, there's no way to really enforce or penalize those who choose not to go up against the line, but to just go over. And we know there's always going to be that. You can't legislate integrity. You can't legislate morality and righteousness and right doing. There's going to be, human nature is such that we're all capable and have the capacity for tremendous good, but we also have the capacity to go the other way too. And that temptation sometimes is too strong for some, but I really feel good about what NIL's intention is and the potential for what it can be. Disruption and chaos is part of any new landscape. That's inevitable, and that's what we're experiencing now. But I certainly don't want to throw out the potential good for a few of the outlying negatives and chaos. So that's my posture. I just think there's a tremendous opportunity to use it to put money in people's pocket that can make a difference. You know, non-revenue sport athletes make a few thousand dollars embracing NIL. That's phenomenal. Being able to maybe help some charities through NIL, leveraging donor bases and those who support institutions in their communities, leveraging that for the good of the student athlete and others. I mean, that's wonderful. To do that is, I think, the real opportunity in with NIL and what it's intended to bring about. We've got a period now where it needs to be reeled in, but I'm hopeful there'll be enough folks that see the positive and really want to embrace it for the good of the games and the athletes and the communities in which they participate.
And then what about with the game itself? I think none of us really saw a vision of where it's come, where we've kept really good college basketball players in the game.
Great point. Great point.
Like Timmy. Like
great point. Bogart,
and it's made the game much, much better. The college game is something you wouldn't, no one thought immediately about.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
And it's so fun to have those guys still playing because they can make some money even though they're not high draft picks. Their game doesn't translate so well.
So
that's been a lot of fun, don't you?
Yeah, that has been. And Jay Wright made that point, which is a really good one, that you have a number of guys that started with the NBA, maybe marginal prospects. We know that there are really average college players that will be great pros. And there are really good college players that won't make it in the pros. It's just the nature of the two games are totally different. So that's fine. But to have the opportunity to monetize some of your notoriety and some of your leverage and connections with your institutions in a game that's throwing off quite a bit of money, in part because of CBS and Turner providing what we do for the media rights to the men's tournament. So being able to share in some of that is huge. And I agree with you. I mean, the fact that some guys are going to be motivated to continue their educational pursuits and play college basketball because they can bridge the gap between a potential pro career and no money at all in college in the past, I think that's a good thing. I really do. I think that's a good thing, a healthy thing.
I think about guys right away who I grew up watching and who I still watch, who played at Ohio State. I don't know why I think of so many guys who were like Jay Burson, who was not going to be a pro. Aaron Kraft. I would have loved to see Aaron Kraft knock out $2 million in college, right? He carried the program on his back. Wasn't going to be a pro. You know, Mateen Cleaves, Jacques Vaughn, all these guys that, you know, weren't going to go on and be great pros. They are pros in that city. They are pros in Columbus. Yes. They're pros in Lexington, and we worship them. So you made a statement that I hope the NCAA and the institutions will step up, because technically they're not paying the players. They are reaping the benefits of having the NIL money. I feel like it's incumbent upon them to really step up educationally and make this the best that it can possibly.
Yeah, and I hope they'd be creative. I don't know much about our new NCAA president, Mr. Baker, but clearly there's an opportunity with this landscape in transition and NIL, a number of different elements. But just speaking of NIL, there's a real opportunity to leverage this in a very healthy and positive way and stiff arm some of the outliers and really make it what it should be for the student athletes, an opportunity to leverage their image and their likeness for their benefit. And institutions should be part of that, the communities, the donor base, collectively looking at it from an educational and financial standpoint. And I think there's enough intelligence and enough appetite, as long as there's some fortitude, to go against the grain a little bit, to be creative and up to date with what the marketplace will allow, with some real thoughtful creativity around serving the student athlete. Because that's not been it has been in word, but it hasn't been in action as much as it could be.
Yeah.
Part of it is, you know, part of that misstep is seeing that this should have already been proactively embraced by the NCAA.
Right. Not reacting.
There was a real app, you know what I mean? Instead of having it forced upon them by the courts.
Right.
And now we're here. Let's maximize it. Let's really reframe it in a way that it that people feel good about is and what it does across the board.
Clark, if we don't get to college basketball, some basketball questions, people around here are going to take Josh and I hostage. But so I want to ask you about who are the teams this year that we need to be taking a look at. And but first, what about from, you know, 50,000 foot view? We kind of get in the weeds here in Lexington and can't see.
Yeah, a little bit. Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. What's going on with our Wildcats?
Man, I tell you, I was surprised at their difficulty to get it going offensively. That's been a bit of a fit and start. And most of the games I've watched, and I've watched probably a half dozen of their games, they've had periods. It just doesn't seem like they're comfortable in how they want to play through Oscar. And then the other guys being able to work off of him for quality, consistently quality shots. Not getting enough off the defense to create some open floor, easier baskets. Not doing that enough. I think the pieces are there, but they just haven't quite fit. So a work in progress, one that I think will find its way, because there aren't really any great teams. I mean, you look at UConn, I think they're the two teams I have the most conviction about getting to Houston today, just based on where we are, would be UConn and Houston. When you watch them, depth, tenacity, experience, skill. I mean, those teams look like there's some storms during the year, but clearly when it's time, they have what it takes to possibly. The other teams, I mean, Purdue, I love watching them play Arizona, love watching them play Bama, Arkansas, Tennessee, Gonzaga. There are a number of those teams, but I would probably right now put Houston maybe a notch above as potential Final Four teams than the rest of the field. And a lot of other good teams, Kentucky in that mix, to maybe develop into that caliber of conviction. But good teams, older teams across the board. Transfer portal helps that. NIL helps that some. So you don't see the significant drop off across teams that you would normally see if you've got a bunch of young guys. But with the older new guys, that team seems to level off. But I think Kentucky just has to get a little better playing around and through Oscar and then being able to create a little more off their defense. So the shot quality isn't just half court. They're getting some easier opportunities. I love their personnel, though. I mean, I think the personnel is pretty good across the board.
Isn't it fun to watch Oscar? First of all, he has this skill of rebounding that I never thought.
He's got great hands. He's got remarkable hands.
And he's fast.
Vice grip hands, man.
Yes, he just finds the ball. But it's also, he's kind of like got this old man offensive game. You know, he looks like the guy you play at the Y who comes and plays in jeans and is just, you know, on his lunch break.
Just wearing you out. Wearing you out.
Just doing these little moves and up and under. And it's so fun to watch him do that, which is part of the translation problem to the NBA. But it's fun to watch him do it on this level. How does this guy get every ball? How does that happen?
Well, and I think Rex would agree with this. Most of your great rebounders aren't usually your tallest guys. Mm-hmm. They have a knack for sensing where the ball is and then just a relentless desire to pursue it. And a lot of them aren't your uber athletes. Mm-hmm. They have great hands, pretty strong, excellent timing, and usually good to great second jumps. They might not get super high, but they bounce. I mean, I was not a great leaper, but I could get up twice more than most guys could. And I had really good hands. And so those are rebounding traits. And I think universally you see that. But he's got a tremendous work rate. I love his disposition. I think he finds his way. I mean, the game at the NBA level has changed dramatically. But I wouldn't count him out because rebounding does transfer.
It does.
It typically always does. He's a little better than Reggie Evans, I think, offensively. Rebounds like that. And Reggie found – I mean, again, that's a different time. But I think there's a place in the right spot. There's a place for a guy with his character and his motor. And he's gotten better at shooting the space up. He's not a terrible passer. And he's a worker. I mean, those kind of attributes sometimes can get you through the door at the NBA level in the right spot. So I wouldn't count him out. But I love watching him work. Love the way he goes about it, too. He's got a great disposition.
Same. And I think about – I just think about – you forget the other guys on the team at Kentucky. Cason Wallace is a special basketball player.
Yes, agreed.
He's an exceptional – and for he plays both ends of the court. He's conscientious, never takes a play off. He defends. He can shoot it.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about – programs in the country, if you got those two guys, you're probably going to find a way to fill those other spots in. And you know, we have veterans this year, we have shooters, just got to find the right, you know, like you said, find the right mix. And I think all the pieces are there.
I like the pieces too. I like Jacob Toppin. I'd like to see him be consistent because I think he does a lot of stuff. I mean, he can pass it, he can defend multiple positions, he can make plays without the ball. I think his consistency is going to be key. I love Cason Wallace. I mean, I think he's so mature for a first-year guy and does everything and had a tough game against UCLA, but that happens. But he's got a lot in his package that bodes well going forward.
Clark, what's your favorite movie?
Favorite movie? I just watched one of my favorites this time of year. It's A Wonderful Life. I can't watch that without crying every time they come in with the basket and throw all that money at George Bailey and what he meant to people because of his care and commitment. I mean, that is something I would hope I would embody, that folks would feel that way about me and Rosie and that we would engender that type of love. I guess the issue is just being loved and appreciated and so forth and impacting people. That's one of my favorites. Shawshank Redemption is up there too, because it's so different than what you think when you first look at snippets in terms of the prison movie. That's one of my favorites. Yeah. What did he say?
I remember the first time I saw Andy Dufresne.
There's several others. You know, we do this, and I need to have my list in front of me. But those are two just right off the top of my list that resonate with me.
Fantastic.
Pretty strongly. Those are two good ones for me.
What about front row center? You could be for any athletic event, any speaker, any group, band, entertainer, dead or alive.
Oh, man. Well, I'm going to go with something, again, pretty fresh. Recency bias here. Okay. World Cup comes here in 2026 to the North America region. And after watching several of the matches in that unbelievable, epic final,
unbelievable.
I can't wait to see if I can scratch that off the bucket list for me and whoever in my family wants to go. I know my youngest son who played soccer at a high level is, we're already talking about it, but that would be one to the global nature of that event and the passion of the people is something I want to be close to and not taste from a TV screen. I would just like to be in the midst of, just be amongst it because it's spectacular. I mean, it just looks the colors, the pageantry, the energy, and the game is amazing game. So that would be one front and center. I would love to be. I got the Birmingham letter that Dr. King wrote. I read it a couple of times a year, and just to maybe be with Dr. King and some of the other civil rights leaders during the time of their great challenge. You know, in hindsight, you look at it and you frame it differently. But in the midst of that fear, that weight, that responsibility. And some of the things he wrote and said, it would be awesome to be in his company as he's penning some of the words that he penned to see him at work and how that came to be. Performers, music-wise, if I could go back, it would be the Temptations in their heyday and actually all of Motown.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Motown.
Yeah.
Just feel that. I mean, the music gets you no matter how old it is now, it still gets you. But if you could actually, and then the other thing would be, I would want to go back to the Indiana Pacers in the heyday of the ABA. Because I got to meet some of those guys, Mel Daniels, Mel Daniels, Bob Nedelecki, Don Boosie, George McGinnis, Darnell Hillman, Fred Thack. I mean, I got to interact with some of those guys, part of the Pacer franchise family. Yeah. But if I could just go back, if I could do a back to the future and go to the Smokefield Coliseum, Colonels obviously had a great team, Hubie Brown and the Colonel. I mean, I read Loose Balls, the book, which is amazing because some of those guys I know personally. But just to be able to be transported back into that would be a remarkable, remarkable experience for me. So those are just a couple of things that resonate. But there's many more. But we got a shot clock.
Great answers. But we usually will call it here, but you got another question in my mind because I saw on your Twitter you were really into the World Cup. Why aren't we any better? And I know it's a cultural thing, but here's the example I use. If we had one global superstar, I think that would be a tipping point for us. You know, we're getting closer to really being a soccer
nation. Yeah. And that young group we've got is pretty impressive.
They are. But if we had
they got a chance. Yeah, they got a chance.
And I don't understand how we haven't in saying that in the NBA, all these players, Giannis and
Embiid.
The Joker.
Dallas.
Luka.
Yeah. Like they have, they've taken over the NBA. Why don't we have one great soccer player?
That's a that's a great point, but I think part of it is the seeds that were sown by NBA coaches and college coaches overseas have germinated. And basketball, I think, is a little faster to grow from a global standpoint. Soccer is such a technical game, and it doesn't have the same esteem that basketball does here. Yeah. So I think some of that is your elite athletes that can excel in soccer tend to have options in other sports because of the cachet and the esteem of football, the other football, and right. basketball. Like my son, I know my youngest son, Nick, and we've talked about this. If he had grown up in Europe, he would have chosen soccer.
Yeah.
Right. I think that was his first love, and he was really pretty elite, even though he juggled both sports. And then ultimately, when it came time to choose, because we were here, he chose basketball. And so I think it's just it's a catch up, and you make a valid point. I don't have an answer for you, Josh. I don't know why we don't have a global superstar. I just think we're still a notch behind the other parts of the world with how the game is esteemed and valued. We've gotten better, but that tends to sometimes those who could be global superstars maybe from gravitating to soccer.
Right. Like sometimes I think
in Europe and other parts of the world, as much as basketball is making some headway, if you're elite in football, the European football, then usually you're being tracked and traced to try to get to the highest level from an early age, and that's being reinforced and stoked.
Yeah. You're right.
And I think it is here.
Well, yeah, I always say, like, sure, if we had, like, Barry Sanders playing soccer since he was four, we'd have had a superstar.
Right.
Case made.
Muggsy.
Yeah. Muggsy. Yeah.
Clark, okay, I've got to ask one more thing. I watch you. I enjoy watching you. It's like putting on a warm winter coat, my favorite slippers, watching you guys. I want you to talk for just a second, because I know I'm good friends with Seth Davis. Seth has been on the show. I know that you're good friends with Seth, but it's kind of more than a friendship. A Jewish kid from the North and a Black kid from Ohio. Talk to me for a couple of minutes right now about that friendship.
Yeah, man, it's brothers from different mothers, quite honestly. When you spend the kind of time we've spent together, on that desk, and then you start enjoying and appreciating each other's seasons of life, and you can find edification, fun, common ground around important people and things, then it connects you. And it's actually a great example of how when we take the time, some of our time is forced through work, but when we do take the time to engage with other people, even if we don't quite come from the same place or look the same or have the same traditions, there's common ground based on our humanity. And so that to me is the driving force. Sure, we love to do what we do. He's a fantastic writer, very cute. I love his energy. I love his experiences. I love watching him parent his three boys because my kids are, we have a girl and two boys, but they're a little older. So some of the things that he's wrestling with are things that Rosie and I wrestle with him. Trying to balance raising versus developing and being friends versus being parents, the life stuff. And yeah. So being able to share that in a way has drawn us closer. And then we have some common interests and passions, but it's been a rich, rich relationship, man. A kinship, comradeship. It's not just a work relationship. And the same with Greg Gumbel too. I mean, when you connect to folks and have common ground, it's bad. But Seth and I have gone pretty deep over the years. We share spirituality. I mean, my faith is in Christ. He's of Jewish background, but there's common ground there too, major common ground. So it's just fun to be around a guy like him. I've been enriched by his friendship, and I trust that it's been mutually uplifting and life-giving.
I know that it has. Clark, can't thank you enough for doing this. This has been a big thrill, personal thrill for me.
Me too.
No, my pleasure. Rex and Josh, great to be with you guys, man. Maybe we'll do it again when Kentucky is rolling a little better offensively. They've worked out the kinks. But even if not, there's plenty of basketball to talk. And I know the folks in Lexington, even though they want to hear about the Big Blue, they don't mind talking basketball across the board either.
I know that if we hear this season in the future, you say that Kentucky has spurt ability. I know we've made a
You know the genesis of that word, right? It was a 1996 Kentucky champion.
I think that is
That's the first time I used that word. I created it because of them, because every game they played, they blitzkrieg somebody 12-0, 10-2. It happened every single game.
Yep, that was the definition of spurtability.
If you made me put a picture of a team in the dictionary, they are it. It was 96. That group. Mercer,
Walker, Antoine.
Delk, Antoine. Yes.
McCarty.
It was those dudes, man. You be going along, it's tight. Boom, boom, boom. Over. 12-2, 14-4. Yeah. Bang.
You know, we always name our championship teams, and that team could have very well been the Spurtables.
Yeah.
Hey, not could have been. They are. They're the genesis of that compound word.
That's right.
They are it. I'm telling you, from the author's mouth. That's it.
Yes.
Thanks, Clark.
All right, fellas. Appreciate it. Merry Christmas.
Do it again. Guys. You too. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
That was great.
It's amazing, right?
That was Special K, the first Special K.
I mean, all of it. I swear, he's one of my first. Well, he's, you know, you get to be middle school age and start taking things a little more seriously, mm-hmm. sports wise, and he was just the guy. He wore 33 at Ohio State, and I wore 33 for a couple years, mainly because of David Thompson. But it didn't hurt that Clark wore it.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you settled in on
three. Yeah, on three. Yeah. What a guy, though. Again,
between two turns.
Yeah. I mean, he's a 20-10 guy his whole life, even in the NBA. It's just what he does. You put him out there for 30 minutes and he gets 20-10. And then all of a sudden, it's over. And look at him here, 35 years later. He's the preeminent announcer for college basketball, the guy. And again, it does. Every time you said it, when you hear that song and you hear that his voice,
mm-hmm.
you know it just feels warm.
Yeah, it is. He's a warm slippers come March.
What a fantastic guy.
That was amazing.
All right. That was episode 70, Josh. You want to do it again next week?
I would. I really would.
Yeah, it's been good seeing you here in Lexington.
To do one together. That's very nice. Yeah.
For Rex Chapman and Josh Hopkins, we'll join you here next week on basketballnews.com.